Most scholars, including developmentalists and social scientists, religiously avoid the messiness of policy debates and the stickiness of complex institutions. It's a little bit like skirting around poison ivy on a springtime hike. Better to stick with studying the colorful synapses of infant brains or carefully to detail the human-scale interactions of preschoolers and their teachers. Many of us would rather haggle with a recalcitrant editor of an obscure academic journal than try to engage a vaguely informed yet sharply opinionated policymaker. But what I wanted to do in the next few minutes is really to enlist you in asking what I call a second-order question, that is, how do we create institutions that provide capacity to enrich environments of kids? That is, how do we create preschool institutions? How do we create childcare networks? How do we create the policy apparatus to sustain richer settings for young children? Not too long ago, the issue was really whether we should do that, whether there should be a public investment in childcare, whether we should expand preschools. And I think, in a way, we still have the hangover of that set of questions. We certainly still have some conservative governors that don't get beyond that question. But I do want to argue that we're at the second-order question of how do we do it? How do we do it institutionally, not whether to do it or not? A related issue is how we disentangle contrasting beliefs about the inborn nature of children, how they are raised within families and within institutions. The nettlesome bundle of ideological and empirical questions has preoccupied modernist thinkers for about five centuries now, not to mention the past half century of scientific work on the question of how childcare and preschool settings affect early learning. That is, what's interesting about institutions is they try to incorporate certain philosophical assumptions about how to raise kids, whether it's sort of a liberal humanist learning through play, developmentally appropriate practices, whether it's more of a skilling agenda, as we're seeing with No Child Left Behind, whether it's a culturally situated view of learning, as we heard from Vani and others this morning. And then institutions also appropriate evidence to try to mount certain arguments. So what I think is interesting, and this is sort of what my new book is trying to focus on, is how political actors and institutional leaders appropriate philosophy and science in fairly haphazard and nonsensical ways. And they have beautiful marketing materials and lovely brochures, and the same two-year-old is plastered across all sorts of advocacy brochures. But the appropriation of evidence and philosophy is a little erratic. Arnold Giselle, the famed developmentalist who helped found the Yale Child Development Center, struggled with a similar mix of philosophical and scientific questions. He was determined to catalog the universal processes of young children's maturation. In fact, his indicators of school readiness included the appearance of children's six-year molar teeth. He called this a convenient punctuation mark of readiness. But at the same time, Giselle practiced pediatrics, as some of you well know, in the truly industrial slums in the Northeast. And as he did his field work, as many of you do day to day in Chicago, he grew curious about how preschool could advance particular forms of socialization and health development. He spoke of a science of child development as a cultural force. And I'm quoting here, about the relationship between maturation and acculturation. That is, he recognized there were these maturation processes in a Piagetian sense, in a biological sense, but he also realized that the way in which kids were being socialized was particular to their setting, particular to their community. In this spirit, I want to try to address these issues in the next few minutes.